Hi, my name is Linda Brady.
And I'm Michael Brady.
Together, we are Partners for Karmic Freedom, and welcome to our third podcast. Before we get really started, I've been wanting to do this now for the last couple podcasts to acknowledge my husband, Michael, for writing the beautiful music that he plays on the guitar. A lot of our listeners have commented on it, Michael, and I just wanted to share that with you. We call it soul dancing.
And it's the only thing I've ever composed on guitar.
That's right. Well, that makes it even more special.
Over 30-some years.
Over 30-some years. 30, it's been more than that, but okay.
Yeah.
Who's right. Counting, right?
Well, I'm not as old as I think
yeah,
I am.
Yeah, right. Before we begin talking about the Aquarian strategies, which is what we were doing today, we had a question from a listener who listened to the second podcast. I'm very happy to get feedback. This is wonderful. He said he was really confused. Because we were talking about, you know, how to transition from Pisces into Aquarius and understand some of the traits and the attitudes of Pisces and how they support Aquarius. Well, he's a very heavy Pisces. He's got a Sun, Mercury, and Venus in Pisces. Apparently. Oh. He knows his chart.
Me too. I have a Sun, Jupiter, and North Node all in conjunction in Pisces. Yeah.
So because you have all of that and you are an Aquarian leader, I'm going to turn this over to you to explain how you've done it, and then I'll have a few things to say about that too. So why don't you talk about how you've done Pisces to Aquarius?
Years ago, I was very confused by all this because it felt like I was going backwards rather than
coming
forward.
Coming and going at the same time.
Coming and going at the same time, right. Kind of thing. Until I finally, with our work together and how we develop our work, began to see that the age of Pisces is about external power and control, God outside of us, and love that is based in sacrifice of self. And the age of Aquarius is based in group process on an earth plane, but individual power and responsibility first and foremost. And love in the age of Aquarius is not supposed to be painful. It's supposed to be sharing the joy with other people, so that the idea of sacrificing oneself in how you love someone is an old age Piscean belief that needs to be transformed into the age of Aquarius version of that. And that took me a while to like figure out and understand. So I still needed to lean back into understanding Pisces at a very deep level in this lifetime, which my chart tells me I'm supposed to do, and then to transfer the older framework into the newer framework and bring forth those same values.
Okay, I have a moon in Pisces, as you know, so my little girl and I have been looking at Pisces and feeling Pisces for almost 79 years now. So what I've learned, though, as my experience, even on an emotional level, is about forgiveness, which I think that was what happened in the age of Pisces. We learned about forgiveness. We learned how important it was. And what we learned, though, was to turn the other cheek and forgive others, et cetera, et cetera. But what we're learning now in the age of Aquarius is that freedom and love comes from forgiveness of self as well as others. And that has been very important for us. You know, many of my clients, you know, say, well, I want to forgive them, but I don't think they'll hear me, or I don't think they'll acknowledge it. And I say, it doesn't matter. You have acknowledged it, and right. You have done what you've needed to do. And that and living in a state of grace, which I believe and feel, come from living in forgiveness. And not having anything, you know, holding us back.
Sure. If you believe in self-responsibility, then if you forgive someone for something they've done to you, you no longer require a response from them. Mm-hmm. The very act of granting it is a completion for yourself. On the other hand, if you're asking someone for forgiveness again, it doesn't really require that they agree to the forgiveness or they respond to you at all. It only matters that you show up and ask for it, because at that point you unburden yourself of the guilt.
Yes. Okay, so this is a podcast on the age of Aquarius, and so we are going to start for the next two podcasts really talk about what it's like to live the Aquarian life in the Aquarian way. Many years ago, 30, 40 years ago now, I had a client who said, you know, Linda, I think you should write the New Age Bible. I think you should write the Aquarian Bible. And back then, I probably didn't know enough to be able to say, no, someday I'll write a book about it, because that was not what I was thinking. But I did say to her, you know, one of these days, I'm going to write the Aquarian poster.
A poster?
A poster.
A quick, and easy read.
Yes. And for those of you that know me, I'm really big and pithy and poignant. So for me, it was an opportunity to really put down certain things that I believed were requirements, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Of what it's like. You know, this is not a whole book. This is not a thing you have to do. It's not a thesis about morality. What it is an opportunity for us to figure out what it's like. If we do these things, how are we going to feel? And how Aquarian will we be feeling?
Right.
Which is why I did this. So why don't you start, Michael, with the
sure.
first one.
Okay, so the first premise of your poster, your Aquarian poster, is I know my soul creates my life experience for my highest good.
Yes. Well, this is a place people get stuck. I did a workshop so many years ago now, and I was talking about creation of parents, creation of life experiences. And I had this guy in the back, it was half asleep, I think, but he woke up enough to say, well, I must have been drunk when I created this. And I laughed because everybody else was laughing. And sure. I said, well, my guess is you created it for very good reasons that your soul knew and maybe you didn't know. And so this whole idea of creation, that where we're co-creators with our soul, to find the abilities to understand our life experience as a positive, not a negative, is very, very important for Aquarius.
Even when you're up to your ass in alligators?
Even when you're up to your ass in alligators.
Which is, in stark contrast, the idea of the age of Pisces, that we come here in sin and we have to work hard and sacrifice ourselves in life to be granted forgiveness from God so that we can go to heaven. And you either go to heaven or hell.
Well, that's the extremism that we're working against, right?
Right. Well, I think having the premise that we get more than one shot here, more than one lifetime, sort of opens up the possibilities of improvement over time, don't you think?
I think. So this posits that the more we understand about our connection to our soul, the more we understand about what our soul's mission is really critical into knowing why some of the things have happened and how we can get the most from it. I believe my soul is my best friend. I believe my soul is my continuity expert. I believe my soul is there always to have my back. It's not going to tell me what to do.
Oh, no, you can't.
Can't do that.
Our souls can't do our life for us. The idea is that we come here to make choices, right?
That's right.
And interestingly enough, the most important aspect of having choice is not knowledge, but lack of knowledge. What you don't know opens up the field of choice. The more you know, the less choices you have.
Right. And yet our soul, in its infinite wisdom, wants to be there for us, to be able to guide us sometimes, maybe sometimes to admonish.
Well, and I think you have to ask your soul for help. I don't think
always.
I don't think it would ever intrude.
No.
In how we direct our life, okay?
No.
But on the other hand, if you're asking your soul for help, other than to make choices for you, I think it's there, you know, to support us in all the ways that we can be supported.
Right. Well, it can help make sense of things. You know, like, why did this happen? And we'll be talking more about that in our next call, too, about bi-level conversations.
I liked having the idea over the years, too, of a personal relationship with our soul.
Absolutely.
So that we made a person out of our soul energy.
Right.
That we could relate to like any other person that we would meet at the mall, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, we live, you know, it's been said that we are spiritual beings walking the earth. So, you know, for us, because we're human and we are physical, I've always said, and I, for myself and for everybody that I serve, find a way to connect on a personal level. Find out how your soul thinks or talks or smells or speaks.
Yep.
And it's very possible, which is one of the reasons I'm a karmic astrologer, because I can look at a chart and I can know exactly what my soul wants, what my soul looks like. And I could do that for everyone, because in the chart, there is that point that says, here is your soul. Now, what are you going to do about it? And how are you going to relate to it? So very important.
I agree. So the second premise of your poster is, I am self-empowered when I take personal responsibility for my life.
Ah, yes. Spiritual maturity. That's the biggest part of Aquarius. I am personally responsible for my life. me, God, my soul, all the pieces, my inner child, all the pieces of me are responsible for doing what I need to do. And that's a difficult one because we were taught to blame other people. Somebody else is at fault.
Sure.
Hardly ever do we say, it's my responsibility, I get it, my bad, whatever, however we want to say that. And being able to do that across the board, regardless of the circumstance, is critical. You know, so I'm not blaming anybody. It's on me. And, you know, that's the spiritual maturity facet of living in the age of Aquarius. Not easy. It's not what we were taught. And it's certainly not, we're not taught to be mature about it, to see the goodness in it, to see the purpose.
Oh, absolutely. For myself, when I was 19 and 20 years old, after I got out of high school, I served a tour in the war in Vietnam, in the Navy, on a base, not off the shore. And my father had suggested that I join the Navy in my junior year because of all the action that was occurring over there, and the draft was active. So they were drafting people back in that war. And he said to me, you should enlist in the Navy because of that way, at least you'll lay off the rice paddies instead of in them. And when you get out of high school next year, they're definitely going to draft you, probably. So not having any political consciousness whatsoever at that point in my life, I went, huh, okay. So I went down and signed up. So I ended up in Vietnam at the age of 19 and discovered that, well, I was scared shitless about being there and desperately wanted to turn around and say, can you help me? Can you help me get out of here? But there isn't anybody. It's 8,000 miles back to home. Your parents can't come and get you. Uncle Sam's not going to rescue you because you're there for Uncle Sam. I was desperate and scared, and I started to drink a lot to cope with that when I first got there. And was playing around with starting to wander into like drugs like marijuana, but alcohol was the only thing I had tried out at that point in my life. So anyway, I got to this place where I woke up every two or three days sober and hungover because you can't maintain a alcohol level indefinitely. And every time I did, I got more depressed, or I became aware of being depressed. And I wasn't even in psychology at that age, so I'm amazed that I had the word in my head like depression, but I did. And I felt like I was cornered. I was caught between a rock and a hard place, and there was no way out. And I thought, I'm not going to survive this. I mean, it isn't like I have to get killed. I don't have to get shot here. Just feeling this way, I don't think I can survive this for a year. So that was the first time in my life where I became self-empowered by taking personal responsibility. I looked around and I thought, what am I going to do? And there's nobody to have the conversation with present in my life. So I decided I was going to take charge of drinking first. And I only drank one day a week for the rest of the time I was there, on my day off on a Sunday. And I needed to make friends because I'd spent the first 6, 7, 8 weeks in Vietnam not really being able to connect with people because I was trying to be as inebriated as I could most of the time. And I decided to join a card game that went on in my barracks every Sunday so that I could sit around and talk to guys in the hooch, we would call it. And those two things not only saved my life in Vietnam, but really created, in spite of the war, a positive experience at that point in my life. I came back from that tour in Vietnam not damaged, not traumatized, and much more in touch with my abilities and my power to steer my own life.
Well, wonderful. At 19, you did all that, huh?
I'm kind of amazed when I look back at
it. Yeah, I know, when you think about it.
I've often stopped and said, how did you do that?
Well, I guess because you were a Piscean and you were self-reflective and you wanted to find yourself in some way living in a state of some kind of grace.
That's a good answer because I started to read it in the third grade. I was going to the adult library and I was reading science fiction books from like Isaac Asimov and Ray Bradbury and Robert Heinlein, the big names of the pioneer of that field. So I was often thinking about myself in my head in the stories I read. So yeah, I guess you're right. I learned to be introspective that way.
Yes. Okay. So the next one?
So the next one is I pursue my soul's mission with commitment and action.
Okay. Well, this is the name of our game here at the whole thing that Michael and I work on, and basically is helping people find why they're here. Clients will call, I want to know why I'm here. I want to know what my, they usually don't say mission, but they want to know what in the world can I do? What am I not doing? What should I do? And all those questions are really, really important. Being able to understand our soul mission is one of the most important things Michael and I teach. And that comes straight out of an astrological chart. That's what we do. We don't make judgments. We don't do anything other than look at the north node in that chart and say, this is what your mission is.
That's right. So my soul's mission is in Pisces in the fourth. The fourth house is about early childhood, emotional, spiritual foundations, our relationship with mom, early childhood, basically, right? Okay, so my south node in Virgo is in the 10th house, which has to do with being out in the world and your career, if I boil it down real quick.
Right.
And when you and I met, I was working out in the world for hospitals, institutions.
As a psychologist.
No, as a psychologist. And you were one of the earliest people telling me, well, Michael, you should actually work out of your home. And I thought to myself, this woman is crazy when you told me that. Because in my gut, I felt very strongly about what I was doing and where I was at.
And your reputation in the world and all of that, right?
And all of that. And the need to go out into the world, not to be at home. Kind of like that really was like my person. I was going, no, that can't be right. And it felt like a gut feeling like, no, she's completely off base. Well, it only took you 3 or 4 or 5 years and my life to unfold in a particular way for me to find out that, indeed, I am most fulfilled and happy when I'm working out of my home, which I'm currently doing and I've been doing for the last 27 years, like that now.
The idea of commitment and action are the important parts of that statement, that it's very, and I've seen this happen, you know, a person can come and I'll tell them what their soul mission is based on their chart. And they'll be really happy and excited and inspired. And then they go out into the world and don't do it.
Well, I had to decide to resign my job positions in the world and then start practicing in a home office out of our apartment, our house together. That's action I had to take. And I certainly didn't feel... I wasn't a believer. I wasn't feeling confident. I wasn't in my gut going, oh, yes, this feels... It didn't feel right up front.
No,
it actually felt against the grain. And I had to do it for a while, 6 months, a year, maybe 2 years of my life, before I could compare in my gut especially. My personality could judge its own bias inclination to work out of my south node in Virgo, as opposed to doing it this weird way that you had suggested to me at the time and going, you know, this really does feel better.
Right. Well, I had to go from being an introvert to an extrovert. That ain't easy.
Me too.
Right. You know.
Me too.
I would be very happy still living in Vermont on our 11 acres with our dogs and you and not doing anything other than that. Just being there in my own personal retreat and blah, blah, blah. But that's not my mission.
No.
So there you go. So go ahead.
All right, so the fourth thing is I love the surprises that create excitement in living a life of serendipity.
Oh, serendipity. Of all the things that I love about
the world. It's a cool-sounding word.
It's a lovely word.
What the heck does it mean?
Well, I'll tell you what it means. And the base word of serendipity is serenity.
Ah.
Aha.
Another S word.
Another S word. Serenity is it being at peace, being centered and being at peace. Serendipity is a philosophy that means that once we take action in the world, the universe moves when we do. A lot of people have an idea that serendipity is basically fate, that we can sit back and things happen to us. Well,
good
that's very Pisces.
Good things happen.
Right. It never works. People that are sitting back
at 89, you're still in your house waiting for
somebody to knock on the door.
Right?
Yeah. Okay, so serendipity is a philosophy of truth. It's a philosophy of faith. It's a philosophy that we can take actions and good things will happen, that unexpected things will happen that we would not ever, ever expect or understand.
Right.
And the thing that I say a lot about this is people who are perfectionistic, let's say, people that have very strong desire to meet certain goals in their life, And if those goals aren't met, they're disappointed. They feel like failures.
Right.
They feel bad about themselves. When, as they've taken the action, all this wonderful stuff is going on outside that they don't ever see because they're so focused on that goal.
Correct.
So if I want to have 100 people in a call and I only get 90, then I'm feeling bad about me. When the reality is all the wonderful people that are on that call and all the ways that that call can help other people is happening, and I'm not paying attention because I'm pissed off that I didn't get 100.
Right.
And that I find with a lot of people who really are end product oriented, that they may say they believe in serendipity, but they don't, because they either sit back on the actions or they're not paying attention
or
to things happening.
Or they try to force the right. The how things unfold into the original way they saw it as their end point or their goal right. or their desire, right?
And
so they ignore any feedback in the process.
They're ignoring the feedback that's all around them.
Yeah.
But they're not paying attention. And it's Goethe that said, he wrote a beautiful poem. He's a German philosopher, I don't know, in the 1700s, I think. Anyway, but he said, he wrote in his poem about serendipity, the universe moves when we do.
Right.
And that is so absolutely true, because actions are going to solidify and concretize what we need to do.
Right. Well, that played out for me in that changeover from having to work out in the world in institutions and hospitals into my home. Because after a couple of years, I could really feel that feedback I'd gotten along the way was that I felt better if I worked out of my home. I could be more balanced inside myself, that I was working with people who were more pertinent, more valuable for me to work with in my own experience or
and they
or
felt
estimation.
Comfortable working
yes,
with
and
you
they
that.
Felt and right. I felt more comfortable right. working at home than I ever did out in the world. So all of that was the feedback I was getting along the way that was telling me this is the right direction, keep going in that mm-hmm. direction.
The key is being aware and keep looking for your symbols.
Yes.
Because you know, we don't get back words for words. We get back with symbol.
Think about what you want, make a plan. Take action, and then
pay attention
while you're going forward to the things that don't fit the plan, the feedback that comes out of the blue that mm-hmm. doesn't seem to be part of what you thought was the journey, because a lot of times those modifications, if they're embraced, really lead you to a place where you end up with a product where you go, this really satisfies me down in my soul, mm-hmm. versus my first idea of what would satisfy me, and it doesn't have that same quality.
And to really be a believer of serendipity, one does need to have faith.
Yes.
Faith that the universe does move in benign ways.
Yes.
Faith that God is benign, and being open to all kinds of possibilities.
This requires optimism even when you're up your ass in alligators.
Right. Yep. And, you know, serendipity is ruled by Jupiter and Uranus. Both those planets have to do with positive, optimistic action.
And change and abrupt change.
And abrupt change.
Cataclysmic change.
That's really good, yeah. Not bad.
Right, exactly.
Because people come and say, I'm really frightened of change. I'm terrified of change.
Right.
And we work that because change is inevitable. Every day we're changing on something. It's constant.
Right.
The only constant.
So you come into this life and you're moving. Your cells are vibrating. You're moving through space and time the whole time you're here, from birth to death. And the world, the universe that you're in, all the parts of it are moving. And there's not even a box outside of it because we can't find the end points or the outside. So it's movement inside of movement. That's what human life really is.
Right.
From the moment we come in until the moment we leave.
And all change is positive.
Everything works for the good.
That's right. That
Wait. How about the bad stuff? You mean the bad stuff works for the good?
Well, yes.
That's
there's
what we
serendipity
mean.
In the bad stuff. Probably as much or more than in the good stuff, really, when you think about
that's
it.
That's true. When life is good, you're coasting.
You're coasting.
When life is difficult or challenging, you're growing, expanding, and accomplishing new things. Seems to me.
Right. I have a quick story about it.
I like coasting, though, every once in a
while. Yeah, coasting is fine. When I was 30. I was about 30. I had really come back to Maryland. I was in San Francisco at the time. Came back to Maryland and decided that I wanted to get a PhD in psychology. Got accepted to get my PhD. I had a master's at that point. So I came home and getting ready, I found a job at a hospital where I could work evening shift so I could be a patient, surrogate during the evening, go to school during the day. I mean, I had my plans strongly in play. And one day on the way to my work at the hospital, I had a head-on collision. Totaled my car, actually damaged my optic nerve, had it really difficult seeing for probably 3 weeks. And didn't get my PhD in psychology.
You didn't?
I didn't. Nope. And I don't know why to this day. I could have gone back the next year, but I went. I remember I was in my car, and I was driving down Reisterstown Road, those of you who are in Maryland, on the left side, and I looked over, and I saw a sign that said Rosewood State Hospital. Now, I'm in the left-hand lane, and I need to make a right turn. And I just did that turn. I don't even think I looked. I went from the left lane to taking that right, drove into Rosewood, and noticed that the principal was still at the office. This was like 5 or 6 o'clock at night. And I went in. I said, "Hi, Sylvia. I'm looking for a job." She said, you want a job as a diagnostician?" I said, "Yeah." And I started working at Rosewood as an educator, then as a vice principal, where I met you.
Oh, yeah, that is where we
met. That's where we met. So, you know,
I never thought I'd end up working at that institution in my entire life until it showed up.
So the reality of the serendipity of that is I didn't get my PhD. You know, I did have a bad automobile accident that could have killed me. And here I, you know, and then all these things. And I say often, I don't know if I'd gotten that PhD, if I could have turned my back on it and become who I am.
Yeah.
You know, because that's a lot to turn your back on.
Well, at the point that I left work in the field, in institutions and hospitals and came home to work and transferred from psychological work to karmic past life regression, astrological karmic work. At home, I thought at the time that was not the right thing to do, but as it turned out, it was the best thing for me to do.
Right. Serendipity, huh?
Yep, serendipity. Okay. So the next one is, I understand that my soul and personality need to be developed and integrated.
Okay.
Now, that's an interesting one for me because we tend to think in polarities, opposites, good, bad, off, on, up, down, black, white, because that's the way this plane is organized. Energy and matter are the only two things that exist in what we call reality here. And in that process of only two things involved, the personality, you know, for me, seemed at odds, particularly when you started talking to me about my soul mission and stuff in life, with my soul mission, with my soul. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, which one is it? You know, do I go over here and I reject that one? Do I accept this one and reject? It doesn't work that way. It's really about integration.
It's
and
always
in fact,
about integration.
As I finally started to comprehend and understand esoteric sciences, all of it is about going past the polarity and forming an integration of opposites or poles.
Right. Well, when you think about the sacred triangle of Aquarius, which is mind, body, soul, that implies an integration. And if you think about just what a triangle is, you've got a foundation, which is all or nothing, right? It's an all or nothing experience. And then you've got a peak, like a mountain peak, that's up here.
Or a triangle.
Or a triangle.
Peak
that's
of a
right.
triangle, yeah.
So I think when it's the soul personality integration, it really is, how do I integrate all of those things? How do I do it? How do I create the third option for the polarity, which seems to be foundational,
right.
except and in Aquarius, it's not. It's a foundational drawing board where we can look at these two things and immediately think, what's the third option? We can't do that if we're stuck in extremism.
Right.
Because then we are stuck right there.
Right.
So soul personality integration is a big part of the work that we do, and we talk about it a lot. Because that, for me, that is how we use the ego that our souls have given us in order to forward our soul's mission. And even though it doesn't feel right or it feels conflicted, it never really is. We have to be able to see that. Like, what is not conflicted about it? What is positive about it? And that takes time.
Oh, God, yes. Takes time.
It takes time.
So the next one is, I know my mind, body, and spirit need to be embraced and understood equal.
That's basically what we just talked about.
Which is an extension of what we just talked about, really. Okay. Mind, body, and spirit.
Well, you know what I think about that?
Yeah.
Think about a stool with three legs. Three-legged stool, right?
Yeah.
And it stands up. It's fine. It's you can sit on it and whatever. You take one of those legs away.
Right.
It's going to topple. And one of the things that I've learned, you know, with my background in psychology and all the psychologists and psychiatrists that I've known along the way, you know, without an understanding, a real deep understanding of soul, we're like that step stool.
Yes.
It doesn't have three legs. And yet the traditional psychologies can't go there because then it's mixing religion or spirituality.
Psychology is not a spiritual science.
No, it's not a spiritual science.
And around the time that we met in my early 30s, and by the time I was in my mid-30s, I was hitting the ceiling in psychology. There were places I ended up in counseling work with a client, where back then I would have called them a patient.
That tells you a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, doesn't it? And I don't even like that word anymore. I would run out of things to say. I mean, there were people who would present situations to me that the diagnostic manual and the principles of psychotherapy just didn't offer them an answer, offer them a way forward a lot. So that spirit part is really important because karmic astrology, karma, having a philosophy, embracing a philosophy that acknowledges that we're here more than one time and that we came here to learn ourselves, learn how to love ourselves and each other, and that we do it through trial and error. God said, shoo, go down there and play with each other until you figure it out. that opened up a whole realm of knowledge and information, of explanation of patterns that people get stuck in, that we all get stuck in, or why we have certain patterns in the first place that are not the best, let's put it that way, for ourselves. So that third part, having a spiritual part, is critically important to achieve wholeness in this life.
Because, well, that's the key word.
Is karmic
wholeness.
Astrology for me and the philosophy involved in it can cover any situation that shows up in life. You can make sense out of the apparent disorder and chaos in this life if you have that third piece.
Right. There's something I'll share. It's a painful story, but it really brought that really home to me in Baltimore. And when I was practicing karmic astrology then, and there was a lovely black lady who came to me, and she sat down, and I said, how can I help you, whatever. And she said, well, my little boy was killed a year ago, a drive-by shooting in Baltimore City. And, of course, that was like, oh, my God, And she said, and I knew about you, Linda, a year ago, but I knew I wasn't ready to see you, that I just knew I needed to grieve and to deal with it. And she said, but now I need to know. Now I need to really understand why my little boy was killed. Not on a psychological level, not around grief and all of that, but she wanted to know why her child was killed on a soul level. And so we did the child's chart. We came up with information that she needed to hear.
You mean karmic information?
Karmic information that you
reasons
are,
he brought in from another lifetime for why that would have
right. So you never think about a beautiful little 3-year-old child bringing in anything other at that.
Yeah.
But that's what she wanted to find out. And I'll never forget. About 3 years later, I get a call from her. She's now an RN. She is married. Well, she's out of the ghetto in Baltimore. She is now pregnant. And inside, I knew, and I didn't say it to her because that's not mine to say, but she said, I think my child has come back.
That's an
interesting
thought.
On a soul level. And I am absolutely positive that's exactly what happened.
The soul of the last baby
came
back to her in a new body.
In a new body with a lot of karmic burned off, if you will, by being shot at 3 years old. Now, I know that's really hard for a lot of people to hear, but you and I have seen that happen over and over again.
That's
We're
true.
Understanding that, makes all the difference, and it makes sense out of bad things happening to good people.
Right. That's right. Shit happens for good reasons.
You got that right.
Well, the next one is, I honor my soul contracts and learn from them every day.
Ah, yes.
Now, that's interesting to me because I would say, from the past life work I've done over the last close to 40 years here, I would say that very few people that we meet and are consciously pay attention to, that could be a sales clerk in a store for 5 minutes, okay? Mm-hmm. Very few people who we consciously pay attention to in the course of our life are actual strangers.
Absolutely.
To us, spiritually speaking, okay? Yep. Because the rules are, once two souls meet on this plane, if they fail to achieve perfect trust and love, which I translate it into win-win as opposed to win-lose in terms of how they love each other, then they must keep coming back over and over and over again until they achieve that. Mm-hmm. So we're in an open contract, with, I don't know, thousands of people in a lifetime. I mean, how many people can we bump into in our current life, right? And the top 10% of that list is like our parents,
our husbands, siblings, children.
Those persons closest to us. And then there's our enemies, the people who are the biggest pain in our butts in our life, whatever that means.
And they're so important,
right?
too.
Okay. They're equally important. In fact, they may even have an edge over the positive people in our life because, again, when we're not coasting, when we're struggling, when we're challenged in life, is what we're really kind of here. We're in the material that we can resolve stuff and accomplish something new and be better at something than we were before. So our enemies aren't actually really our enemies.
Nope.
They are actually very strong, loving soul contracts before we incarnate with each other to agree to their own free will to be the pain in our butt, if you will.
I talk about the cosmic coffee shop on the other side.
Right? Yes, you do.
I do. I talk about that a lot. And it was, for me, one of the most important things because I created in my life a stepfather that wasn't particularly good. And I, you know, and up until a certain point, you know, I blamed him for this and that and the other thing. And, you know, he's alcoholic, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And one day I realized that I had really chosen Doug. He was part of my contract that I needed to learn from, right? And so I started thinking about it. Okay, so his soul and my soul are in the cosmic coffee shop on the other side. And I'm going down second. He's going down before me.
Right.
So I'm saying, it's up to me now to decide what kind of contract we're going to have. And I say to Doug, you know, when I come down, I'm going to be your stepchild. And you and I are going to have problems. And I'm not going to like you. And you're going to be abusive to some degree to me. Will you accept that challenge? Will you accept that contract?
That role.
That role in my life. Because it's not a person who would say, yes, I'll do it because, you know, I hate you. They would say it because they love me.
Well, souls couldn't do anything out of hate, could
they? That's right. So he would say, all right, Linda, I'll take that on. I'll be that person for you. Now, clearly, he's going to have his own fish to fry. But for me, he's going to do exactly what he needs to do in order to honor the contract that we have made.
Right.
And contracts are also made to be broken. There are couples that come to you and I whose marriages are not going to work. And we say, you know, you've had a contract. The contract was about this, this, and that. And now the contract is over. And now you move on. And sometimes that takes a sting out of bad divorces. You know, we don't have bad divorces in our practice.
Right.
I don't think we ever have had one.
No.
No, because it's they're
well,
doing
if
this.
You're taking responsibility for yourself and you're in a marriage that's not working well enough, let's put it that way, a functional statement, and you decide that, well, one person gets stuck most often.
Right.
They don't want to do the work or they don't think there's anything wrong, that kind of thing. You have to have two people in order to improve the game, right, involved. And in those instances where that doesn't happen, then it makes functional sense spiritually, karmically, to break off in the exercise of trying to love each other in perfect trust and love and come back around, right? Now, if you live more than one lifetime, that's an option.
Right.
You can see that as a possibility. And there's no harm in foul in saying goodbye for now any time that we're in a life with some other person, because we're going to keep coming back around until we work it out anyway.
Until we work it out. So, you know, that's the whole thing about personal responsibility, that we have chosen those soul contracts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they are, you know, I say a lot, you know, people say, well, I had this horrible family and a horrible parents. And I say, has it ever occurred to you that you chose them in order to learn what not to do?
Yep.
Oh, I never thought of that, because they're there to show you a piece of yourself that karmically you need to move away from.
Right.
They're doing you a favor.
Right.
And oftentimes people don't get that, but that goes back to, I choose myself, my soul contract, and I am responsible for them.
Right.
Okay.
What if you're creating your life completely, every part of it, whether you know it or not?
More or less.
More or less. Right. More and less.
And less, right.
Right. Not more or, more and. So the next one is, I resolve past life conflicts and actively free myself from guilt.
Well, this goes back to forgiveness, doesn't it? So if I understand what kind of conflict I've had with you, and I've understand it, I deal with it, I work on it with you, I ask you to forgive me, you ask me to forgive you, there's nothing else to be done.
Well, this is where past life work has really been powerful for me in understanding how things work here in this life. Because when you're in conflict with someone in your current life, current incarnation, and you can actually look at, get in touch with through past life regression, with your contract with them the last time. Like I would have a client sit in a chair and get them to relax, help them go in their unconscious mind, yada, yada. And when they're there, I say to them, now I want you to feel what your feeling is with the person that applies in this life that we're talking about. Your husband, your wife, your dad, your mom, your boss, whoever. And I get them anchored into the feeling, which is going to be mad, sad, scared, ashamed, or guilty. It's not going to be glad, or otherwise we wouldn't be doing past lives probably, right?
Right.
Okay. And once they're connected with their emotion in their body that fuels the contract they're in with that person, then I ask their unconscious mind and their soul to take them back to the last time they incarnated with that person.
Right.
So they go to the previous lifetime from the one that we made the contract with in the here and now. And when a person does that and they get a story that overlaps and correlates with the issues and the challenges and the conflicts you're having with that person in this lifetime, it blows their mind.
Sure.
Because it's so hard to deny that would just happen. So that connection between the past life and the current life gets established, and then there's a whole feeling thing that I do at the end, a healing process I do with them to bridge the wrong, let's call it, in the past lifetime and heal that. And I strongly believe that energetically, like if you drop a rock in a pond and it makes those waves that come out from the rock, that energy shift in the past lifetime moves forward and comes into our present life and literally rewrites our biography from our birth up until the present time, and then changes us physically as well as spiritually and emotionally as our bodies move forward, so that people literally feel the healing. They feel the impact from the past life material impacting their current life and their current drama that they're caught up in. And it's an amazingly powerful process. And it allows people to let go of grudges, to
let go of the
past, ask forgiveness, to grant forgiveness, and to let go of their own guilt.
That's right. Okay.
So the next one is, I know my soul connects to all souls with love and respect.
That's the ultimate, isn't it?
Yeah, that goes back to the up in the coffee shop thing, you know, before
yeah,
the incarnate, right? Like, you know, we set up these contracts with the top 10% of our list here, of the players that we're going to bump into down here. And they're going to have conflicts. They're going to have traumas involved. Yeah. All of us have that in life. So, yes, that's, you know, that's done out of love on a mm-hmm. spiritual level, not out of animosity.
That's right. And that's hard for some people to get. And it really is true, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
That really is. And the last one is, I love and honor myself as I love and honor others. That's interesting to me, because the age of Pisces really propagated that we would love ourselves last.
Yes.
First, we have to love everybody right. else perfectly well, and then maybe we can love
whatever's
ourselves.
Left.
We'll deserve to love ourselves. And I think it's been backwards. Now, it has a reason. It had a reason to be backwards. But as we go into the age of Aquarius, the age of Aquarius is exactly the opposite order. I think if you're taking responsibility for yourself first before you take responsibility for other people, then taking responsibility for other people is not going to be a stretch. It's not going to deplete you. It's not going to be painful for you. It's going to be done out of excess, out of extra energy, extra love, extra happiness, extra ease kind of right. thing. And that's really the way love is supposed to work between people here, I think. So the loving yourself first and honoring yourself first is a very foundational step to being able to do that kind of extension to other people, I think.
And modeling that for them.
And modeling
that
for them.
Which is really, right. really, really important.
You know, in education, well, you're an educator, I'm a psychology person. Mm-hmm. In both of those fields, it is often said that, in psychology I learned, one of the most powerful ways that you can teach anybody anything is to model it, which right. basically means do it.
Do it.
And feel it that way for yourself. Not explain anything, just show up and be that person. And proximity leads to magnetism, which leads to stuff kind of rubbing off on each other.
Well, it also represents how, as we are doing this poster, we're happier. We're more at peace. We feel better. We feel physically better. I'll be 79 years old at the end of this year. And I think I'm doing really well, considering...
Well, you're not in a wheelchair.
Well,
you haven't got Alzheimer's.
I am fine.
And you're
still
cranking out work like 8 and 10 hours a day.
That's
so, yeah,
right.
I think you're doing okay.
I think I'm doing okay. All right. So I guess you would agree with my poster, huh?
I do. I love your poster.
Oh, you love my poster. So.
I'm glad you didn't write a book.
Yeah. Well, actually, I did.
Well, you did, actually.
I did.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have to take that
yes,
back.
Yeah. Well,
first, you wrote a poster, and then you
Then wrote I wrote the book. Well, the book, Discovering Your Soul Mission, New Rules for a New Age, literally goes into all that we've talked about. It goes into soul contracts and the difference between a soulmate and a karmic relationship and all those things. So that people, if you all want to get more information, I'd definitely go to that book because it really does bring up all the things Michael and I've been doing for years and years and years around the Aquarian poster. So
what's up for the next show?
All right, the next show is going to be more strategies and techniques. We're going to talk about energetic laws. And we're also going to I'm going to share with you a really cool technique I developed called bi-level conversations
Ooh.
That are really good strategies for day-by-day living.
That sounds sexy.
It is sexy. And so that's what we're going to do. And as always, we're open to all kinds of feedback. I was really glad to get the feedback from the Pisces.
We love feedback.
And we love doing this work. And so we're going to sign off now, and we'll see you next week.
Okay. Take care, everybody.